This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. A young man was killed by police in Fresno, California in June. Dylan Noble was pulled over while in his truck and ordered out. Police claimed that he refused to show both his hands at the same time and that he muttered something to the effect of, "I hate my life." Officers shot the 19-year-old four times. Dylan Noble was pronounced dead at the hospital. Police officers were wearing body cameras, but the footage has yet to be released. Dylan Noble was not a young black man. He was a young white man. And he was one of seven people shot at by police in Fresno this year alone. Days later, at a vigil, friends, family, and other residents of Fresno County gathered on the side of the road where he was killed. But what marred the vigil was that at least one Confederate flag was flown alongside a sign saying "White Lives Matter." Joining me now is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina, a regular guest and a correspondent for Rising Up. Welcome back to the program, Chenjerai.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's talk about this, the particulars of this case. It appears as though, and of course we know this is true, that while police officers disproportionately kill people of color, in particular African-Americans, in particular black men, of course there are people of other races killed. And Dylan Noble was one of the rarer cases of young white men being killed by police. It shouldn't surprise us that such a thing has happened, right?
Absolutely not. I think many times people confuse the disproportionate killings of black and brown people by police as meaning that they're the only people that are killed. And that's not at all true. There's other ways we can look at these disparities. We can look at them according to economic class, and also, you know, mental health and things like that. So, yes, it's unfortunate whoever is killed in these cases.
And the story, at least the one that we know so far as is being reported in the media, also sounds like a familiar one, that police were basically pursuing this young man. He was riding a big jacked up truck and was doing donuts in the sand. But police responding to another call about someone who is armed saw this young man and tried to pull him over. They actually didn't have cause to pull him over, but they did pull him over. And when he stepped out, they shot him. Is this the, and you know, there's even some sense that maybe he was reaching for his wallet. Again, a sort of familiar playbook, right?
That's right, yeah. And so what we really see is a certain pattern with the way that police do their jobs and, you know, just this ridiculous approach to use of force that, again, is both a policing and a racial issue. But certainly white people are not exonerated from this. Policing is a problem, really, in the United States, period.
So what about the fact that there is body camera footage? We should also really, I think, accept or admit that much of the demanding for police accountability from the Black Lives Matter movement has resulted in police starting to wear body cameras, even though body cameras are problematic. But there is body camera footage here. Why do you think the police haven't released it yet?
Well, I think that there's typically an obstruction of justice on the part of police departments. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about a similar case, which was the Zachary Hammond case here in South Carolina, where it was extremely hard to get body cam footage. And often what you see is police departments having to be sued or Freedom of Information Act requests having to be filed. Here in Greenville, for example, and I would actually recommend this to the protesters there in Fresno, I mean, it was the Greenville News who had to actually, file a Freedom of Information Act request and then eventually sue the police department to get both the name of the officer and the video footage.
So let's talk about Zachary Hammond. And that was a big reason why I invited you on our program, Chenjerai. Zachary Hammond was a young white man killed in South Carolina. And you were, this happened in the sort of thick of the Black Lives Matter movement. And you got involved. I understand you met his family. And I think it was an important gesture, particularly for people who feel like the Black Lives Matter movement only cares about black lives and black people. Tell us about that experience that you had.
Well, first, I just want to say, in the case of Dylan Noble, it's just really a tragedy. I want to honor, just these lives that are lost in this terrible way. From what I understand, Dylan Noble was a very caring person, and similarly, Zachary Hammond was a tragedy. And I think first and foremost, I mean, just knowing these families, whether they're black families or white families, and seeing what they go through, for them, even now, a year after this has happened, it's still their families are still coming to terms with this. But I think that these things are, there are similar cases in some ways where you have police kind of rolling up on people based on something, for whatever reason that they had to approach and question, and then shooting unarmed 19-year-old people. And the idea that the Black Lives Matter movement is not supporting cases where white people have killed, I think, is completely wrong. And so I think that here, I would say in the Zachary Hammond case, I would blame that particular narrative more on the lawyer, Eric Bland, than I would on the family. The family was just traumatized and really looking for support anywhere they could get it, and not really getting it from most members of the Seneca community. The lawyer, in an attempt to get attention, ran with this idea that if it was a black person, somehow there would have been more attention.
Wow. So let's talk about the racial dynamics that crept into this story of Dylan Noble as well. At the vigil, as I mentioned, where he, where his family and friends gathered to remember him, there were, of course, a lot of candles, there were a lot of signs, photographs of him. Some people were flying US flags, and then randomly, Confederate flags showed up and a sign saying White Lives Matter showed up. Now that was sort of blown up in the press as some kind of statement by, and it's not clear if the Confederate flags and the signs saying White Lives Matter were necessarily related. They might have, in fact, been brought by separate folks. The Confederate flag, first of all, is one thing. The Confederate flag is an overtly racist symbol, right? I don't know if we can kind of misinterpret that any other way. The question is, was it Dylan Noble's family and friends who brought it, or some sort of white supremacist group looking to take advantage of his death? What do you think?
I mean, I heard some of his friends say that you had to know Dylan. And just as the case here is the case here, for some reason, many people in South Carolina have an affectionate relationship with this overtly racist symbol. And I don't think that that is separate from racial attitudes that are that are part of what's going on with that, and really ultimately the system of white supremacy. I mean, we're not simply talking about attitudes. We're talking about a flag that was on the state house, so it's embedded into policy and just an overall logic of white supremacy in this state and in this country. And but at the same time, people's personal relationship to it, sometimes they don't seem clear that that's what's going on. So I think that that may have been the case here. I mean, I think the area where Dylan Noble was from what I understand, is maybe not the most urban area. And
It's
now, when
sort
it
of
comes,
it's white and rural, basically, and also low income.
right, exactly. That so you have those kind of dynamics, in this atmosphere in which Trump is raising his version of xenophobic fascist populism and all these other kinds of things. On the phrase "White Lives Matter," Sonali, that was an interesting slogan to choose, and I think unfortunate one, because it reminds us of the false equivalency that people attempt to draw really between black power and white power. Black power being a movement in support of rights and political power that were denied to black people by a white capitalist, white supremacist, violent system that was legally encoded in the US until at least 1965. And so, and then white power being really a slogan meant to try to preserve that kind of system. So phrases like white power, or even white lives matter, all lives matter, or blue lives matter are efforts to maintain that power. And in a sense, you don't even have to say "White Lives Matter," because it's what's being said every time a police officer kills an unarmed black person like Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, or Sandra Bland, and is not convicted, which has so far been the case in all of those situations.
So, in the footage that we found of the vigil held for Dylan Noble, there was a sign saying "Justice for Dylan," and right next to it, a sign saying "White Lives Matter." Do you think that that sort of gives you the sense that there is an ignorance around, and really a racial privilege around police brutality and who it ordinarily targets? On the part of many white Americans, that when the police violence impacts them personally, it is seen as this incredibly tragic thing. But when police are killing black folks and brown folks, that white Americans, many white Americans, not all by any means, but many white Americans just continue with their lives. And in their minds, probably that police violence was justified.
Well, I think that, certainly what I can say, really trying to be respectful to the trauma that the Hammond family is going through, is that this situation that happened to their son was a learning process for them about areas, really about the extent of problems with the police. In many of these communities, people are very supportive of the police. That
Because
certainly
police
happens here in
usually do
Seneca.
protect and serve them.
Absolutely. And so I think that there is sometimes a little bit of, a surprise or a difficulty reconciling when they watch these kinds of things happen and then actually watch the state form against them in an effort to protect these police officers. And I think that that's disconcerting for any family that deals with that, regardless of race or ethnicity, but it is particularly if you've been somebody who hasn't had that kind of experience. I just also want to say though that, I do think the real focus here must be on these police officers and what's going on with Jerry Dyer. What's going? What you know? We need to get that body, those body cams. And I would urge those protesters, if in some way they hear this, to file those Freedom of Information Act requests and be vigilant about getting that body cam footage. And really, let's find out what happened here. I think that the default to the kind of racial sensationalist, oh, where's Black Lives Matter on this? That's maybe sometimes an effort to try to get headlines in the absence of better organizing efforts.
And Jerry Dyer is the Fresno police chief. Do you think it's going to take a Freedom of Information Act request from the press to get this body cam footage?
I think it will take organizing to get justice for Dylan Noble, and that organizing will need to be across racial and ethnic lines. And there's going to be a need to try to find out who else has been the victim of injustice by this police department and other kinds of systemic injustice. In the case of Michael Brown, what we've seen, Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, all these cases where we've seen larger response, it's been because different kinds of activist groups got together and supported each other. And so sadly, because you're in the process of trying to mourn, it looks like people in this community are really trying to mourn someone who was a friend, a family member, a son, and so forth. That you want to just mourn, but you also have to try to find a way to organize. And I think that's what it's going to take. It's these police departments don't give up the footage, they don't give any ground willingly, and they simply refuse to be held accountable in most cases.
And of course, what's the point of body cameras if the footage isn't going to reveal what really happened? I mean, for years, police officers were able to get away with saying and making claims about suspects that they shot. Oh, he reached for his wallet, reached for, we thought he was armed. Okay, let's put body cameras on you. Or many of them, some police departments have voluntarily taken that up. And so that footage, which could clear up their claims, when it seems to be incriminating footage, is just never given up without a fight, if even that. And then, what's the point?
No, that's absolutely right. And I mean, many people who have criticized, many people who are in the movements fighting for, criminal justice reform and really criminal justice transformation have critiqued the focus on body cam footage. It's undoubtable that the images that we see from these cameras add something to, these cases, but it's also the case that there's a deeper framework and a deeper problem. I mean, in the case of Zachary Hammond, on the day of that it was announced that Mark Tiller would not be indicted and would face no charges, they also released this extremely damning video footage, which I think many people were just shocked to see the way in which this officer just came out and the way in which, the narrative they had provided was ultimately deceptive and looked a lot different than what we saw on the tape. And so in the case of Dylan Noble, we have a narrative from the police officers that he seemed mentally unstable, or that he was seemed deeply threatening and had his hands behind his back and all this. And, you know, I mean, that maybe that's true, but we definitely should push for that tape. And by the way, I just to underscore the point you're making, not just the tape, we also have to look at the deeper framework that's going to come to bear on how the tape is interpreted and becomes a part of a process for justice.
Right. And the final sort of aspect of this in looking for justice for the killing of Dylan Noble, how important is it for there to be cross-racial organizing and for there to be solidarity, particularly given that police violence does impact people of all racial backgrounds, some racial backgrounds much more than others, but still there's, you know, there are few sort of groups left untouched. And you know, to the credit of many white progressives, you do see people taking up the call for Black Lives Matter, joining in, holding signs, marching. There are groups like White People for Black Lives, etc., which are absolutely crucial. But when you do have a white victim of a police officer, for there to be that cross-racial solidarity can be a very powerful thing. It can really put the authorities on notice that they can no longer get away with killing white or Black people.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think in my experience, it was a Black Lives Matter activist who first told me about Zachary Hammond. And again, I don't mean to talk about Hammond to the exclusion of Dylan Noble. I hope we can draw these parallels. But I think that many Black activists are interested in trying to support these other cases because they recognize that transforming criminal justice will affect the Black community disproportionately. But I think that that's why like problems like this Confederate flag and these strategies like this White Lives Matter sign are so insidious and so damaging in a way, because I think when people are being called hypocrites when they're trying to strategize, it really works against it. And one other thing I just want to say is, again, just bringing it to South Carolina, you know, there's so many cases. I mean, you have Zachary Hammond, a white 19-year-old teenager who was tragically murdered by this police officer. But you also, in the same time frame, have Joyce Kernell, who died in July 22nd, shortly before Zachary Hammond. You have Ernest Smalley, Ernest Russell Jr., and Lori Ellis, going back as far as 2008, who Radley Balco recently wrote about. I mean, those are all Black folks. And I would argue none of these cases really has that much attention. So each of these folks are laboring on their own to try to produce police accountability. And one wonders what would happen if they were all to unify and to also unify with people like Dylan Noble's family and friends that are trying to seek justice for him.
Chenjerai, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure you'll be back soon on this show. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chenjerai Kumanyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina, and he's a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can find our website at risingupwithsonali.com, where all of our interviews can be viewed in video and audio format. We'll be back.